What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Anna Salton Eisen, co-author of the powerful memoir, A Pillar of Salt. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, we're headed into the last week of public school for the year. We've been experiencing various graduations, commencements, and promotion ceremonies for a couple of weeks already. This has been a particularly good period for these events, since we haven't had much of them for the past two COVID-19 thwarted years. As a guy who's never really found the actual ceremonies of graduation to be enjoyable, can't believe people think Shabbat services are boring compared to graduations. It's a sign of the deep strangeness of the last 2 years that I'm actually enjoying these graduations and siyum, end of the religious school year celebrations and commencements and all those stultifying manufactured ceremonies. I'm finding them actually kind of fun these days. The sheer normalcy of being able to be there in person and watch people wear silly robes and square hats and to listen to endless lists of names after weird Zoom ceremonies and Facebook graduations the last couple of years, well, it's a great relief. My middle son, Gabe, graduated back in December 2020 from college, and there couldn't possibly have been much less ceremonial celebration. Nobody flew in for Zoom events, and even the touching and inspiring things that people said about him at the end of the year program at Hillel, which was highly gratifying as a father and completely surprising, to be honest. Anyway, even though Gabe delivered a pretty fantastic speech himself, if I say so, it was all peculiarly artificial. Small boxes of people in casual clothes speaking on a small screen from their small apartments in front of a computer camera. And so, while my own feelings about the incredibly dull nature of most graduation ceremonies remain intense and unhappy, this year they are getting a pass. It's great to have important coming-of-age rituals like graduation seem normal again, even if normal is really boring. Anyway, as to normalcy in this troubled world at large, in view of the horrifying war of Putinian aggression in Ukraine, the spiraling inflation of our economy, boy, try to buy gas these days without taking out a second mortgage, and the toxic nature of nearly all political discourse in America, returning to even the pedestrian normality of dull ceremonies like graduations has a genuinely good feeling about it. Now, if we can get even more people to just come back to Shabbat services regularly, we will really have something. We're also in the midst of the period in Judaism of the counting of the Omer now, the 7 weeks between Passover, the festival of freedom, and Shavuot, the celebration of covenant at Mount Sinai. Each evening this spring season, we perform a brief ritual, chant the blessing for the counting of the Omer, and add a short spiritual reading or meditation or chant related to one of the mystical aspects of God, the Sfirot of Kabbalah. In the days of the temple in Jerusalem, our Israelite ancestors brought a special offering of barley each day. The measure itself was called an omer, hence counting the omer, signifying their devotion to God, offering a bit of their best. So to play us in this morning, here's Benny Friedman singing the meditation that's part of some Sfirat Omer countings. Rachamona de onelaniye anena li sfire libo. compassionate God, answer us as we count these days from the heart.
Rachamono Dione, Dione la'aniye, Dione la'aniye, Aneino. Rachamono Dione, Dione la'aniye, Aneino. Rachamono Dione, Dione la'aniye, Dione la'aniye, Aneino. Rachamono Dione, Dione la'aniye, Aneino. Rachamono Dione, li svirei libo, li svirei libo, Aneino. Rachamono Dione, li svirei libo, Aneino. Rachamono
That was a meditative song from Benny Friedman for the Counting of the Omer, now in its fifth week, headed towards Shavuot in early June. Our guest this morning, Anna Salton Eisen, has co-written a powerful memoir, discovering her father's Holocaust experience, her own experience as a second-generation survivor, and much more. Find out all about it when we return here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Anna Salton Eisen, who is not too long ago guest here on Too Jewish, has written a remarkable book, Pillar of Salt, A Daughter's Life in the Shadow of the Holocaust. Welcome and good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
So I want to start with the title of the book. It's a remarkable experience as you kind of discover the Shoah past within your family. Tell us about, Lot's daughter and how A Pillar of Salt became the title of your book.
Well, I think, starting at the beginning, I grew up in a home with two parents who were Holocaust survivors, and it was not uncommon that it wasn't talked about. And as I started to realized that, we had a different family background, history, and hear words like boxcars and camps, I started my own kind of secret search. And as my parents began to realize that I had this curiosity and that I was committed to really find out, they were concerned for me. And, you know, frequently we had conversations that they warned me that I might be changed or that it might, you know, distress my father to talk about it. And so I started to feel like, you know, this Bible character and story was something that I related to, that I was going to turn back, even though it would be painful and difficult and might change me, because I had to face the terrible truth that was part of Jewish history, my family history, and indeed world history.
Your father's experience of the Holocaust in particular is, I mean, amazing that he survived. It's extraordinary. He was in, I think, 10 camps and ghettos. You didn't really know that growing up.
No, I didn't know that he had been in 10 camps in Poland, Germany, and France. I didn't even know his real name. I didn't know anything about my grandparents, except for that my grandmother, who I'm named after, you know, I eventually learned died in a gas chamber. And even anything about his brother or his growing up, it was kind of like, you know, he had amnesia. It was just never talked about. And I think on the occasions that I tried to, you know, approach him about it, I could just see the anguish and despair. And, you know, like many children, you pick up the subtle signs from your parents to not talk about things that are taboo.
The book is called Pillar of Salt, and we will talk much more with Anna Salton Eisen about her book and about her family, about her own experience of discovery when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. That's 276-5675. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us each Friday night and Saturday morning. You can email me, rabbi at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or come on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. Torah study precedes them at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services are in person, but also by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi at BeitSimchaTucson.org. Wonderful religious schools available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses in person and on Zoom, and all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest this growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Southern Arizona and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or go to our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating and review 2 Jewish. Give us 5 stars, or maybe 6. Well, 5 pointed, never mind. Wherever and whenever you listen to our podcast, all those comments help us. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we've been doing a fun thing here on 2 Jewish, talking about ways of rating the best Jewish holidays, like you would rate an Uber ride or a Yelp review of a restaurant or something. So it brings up a question to a guy who has had holidays in many interesting places. First of all, what's your favorite holiday, and what's the most interesting Jewish holiday you've ever spent anywhere?
Both good questions, very different answers. I think by far my favorite Jewish holiday is Pesach, which we celebrated recently. But I've almost always been 69 years out of 70 with my family, either in St. Louis or in Washington, D.C., or last year in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. But it's been not radically different, except that each Seder is different from the one before it, even though we often do two in a row. They're all different.
Yeah. And they're supposed to be, actually.
I mean, Pesach is the holiday of memory par excellence. And I'd like to read a little thing about why I like Pesach so much.
Please.
And then I'll answer your other question about where's the most interesting Jewish holiday.
We get a double header and they're different.
Okay. So in each of us, there is an Egypt and a Pharaoh and a Moses and freedom in the promised land. And every point in time is an opportunity for another exodus. I think it's that message that makes Pesach so valuable to me. Egypt is a place that changed you to who you are, constraining you from growth and change. And Pharaoh is that voice inside that mocks your attempts to escape, saying, "How could you try being something today that you weren't yesterday? Aren't you good enough just as you are? Do you even know who you are?" Moses is the liberator, the infinite force deep within, an impelling and all-powerful drive to break out from any bondage, to always transcend, to connect with that which has no bounds. But freedom and the promised land are not static elements that lie in wait somewhere. They are your own achievements, which you may create at any moment in anything that you do, simply by breaking free from whoever you were the day before. Last Passover, you may not have yet begun to light a candle, or some other mitzvah still waits for you to realize its full potential. This year, defy Pharaoh and light up your world with unbounded light.
Beautiful.
So that challenge, yeah, to me, is why Pesach is the best holiday.
Yeah, because Pesach touches every part of us and touches every one of the senses, and we have so many familial memories.
Right.
So where's the most interesting Jewish holiday you've ever spent?
All right. Well, it's a tie, I have to say. Two places in the old Ottoman Empire. One called Bursa, that was once an Ottoman capital long before the conquest of Constantinople, and still has a functioning Jewish community and a synagogue.
So where is Bursa?
Bursa is, if you go by road on the way from Istanbul to Izmir, it's sort of
inland,
southwest
a
little bit of Istanbul and northeast a little bit of Izmir. It's in the mountains.
In the mountains, okay.
And it was an early Ottoman capital. It's a beautiful city.
Okay.
And there's a very old Jewish community there with which I once spent Rosh Hashanah. They were very welcoming and very hospitable. The other place is the place that Ataturk was born, Thessaloniki. We've talked about Thessaloniki before.
Been there, both of us been there. You've been there right. Many times. Lovely, lovely.
So
town.
One year I spent Yom Kippur there, and what fascinated me was how different are their ways of breaking the fast at the end of Yom Kippur. They break the fast on a hot meat soup, and they do also a mixture of apple and honey, which we do before the fast, but not after.
Right.
They do a number of things either that we don't do at all, or we do at a different time in the course of observing the high holidays.
So more interesting food, and Thessaloniki is always a fabulous place to visit. Tom, thanks, and we will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie do, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Dina was ill, so her sister Shira called to see how she was doing. Dina's 10-year-old son Moishi answered the phone. Hello, Moishi whispered. Hi, honey, it's Aunt Shira. How's your mother doing? She's sleeping, Moishi answered, again in a whisper. Did she go to the doctor? Shira asked. Yes, she got some medicine, Moishi whispered. Well, don't wake her. Just tell her I called. What are you doing, Moishi, by the way? Again, in a soft whisper, Moishi answered, practicing my trumpet. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. Don't practice your trumpet if somebody's sleeping, by the way. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bahar from the book of Leviticus, establishing the rules for the sabbatical and jubilee years. This is the most important form of environmental legislation in the ancient world. Concern for the health of the environment in Judaism has always been an important part of our tradition. The very first text on caring for the natural world goes back to Genesis, where we are commanded to be stewards of God's creation. But the most important Jewish legislation in the Torah is found here in Leviticus. In a section we read in Parshat Behar, this week's Torah portion, you shall have a sabbatical every seventh year. The land must rest. We're instructed to do no active planting or cultivation, to allow fields to lie fallow, to give the earth a chance to rest. This is considered to be good practice today, practical agricultural policy. It allows time for nature to restore nutrients that grains leach from the soil, allows the fallen fruit of the orchards to nourish the loam. It's a fundamental part of crop rotation in all areas practicing contemporary farming techniques. But the remarkable fact about this Shemitah, this sabbatical mitzvah, is that it originated here in the Torah, a document at least 2,500 years old, and which contains texts that might be 600 or 700 or 800 years older than that. That is, the scientific concern for the health of the environment goes back 3,000 years in Judaism. And the requirement to care for the natural world as responsible human beings is at least as long-standing. There are many more commandments in the Torah relating to stewardship of the natural world. Even in warfare, we're prohibited from destroying our enemies' fruit trees or seriously damaging the productive capacity of the land to feed its inhabitants. This is in sharp contrast to the ancient Roman Empire's policy of sowing salt in the fields of some conquered enemies to destroy them, to force starvation. Ironically, it's also in contrast to the occasional policy of the Israeli military to bulldoze the olive trees of Arab terrorists' families. The injunction is clear. We are to respect the natural environment. It is a reflection of God's holiness projected into our world. It's also a not-so-subtle hint that we need to use renewable sources of energy, solar, geothermal, wind power, that do not damage the world that God has given us. There are other contemporary consequences of this most ancient commandment. The sabbatical year off from teaching, so beloved on university campuses, comes directly from this week's portion of Bahar, a time to recharge batteries and renew scholarship, just as the land replenishes itself through a year of Shemitah, divine rest. A great lesson in a world in which we often seem more intent on domination than cultivation, and a reminder that even renewable resources need tending. The same can be said for us. We too must take a day each week, a kind of weekly sabbatical, to restore our own equilibrium. It's called Shabbat. May we learn Bahar's lesson and allow our land to renew itself, and then we might even learn to allow ourselves some rest and come to replenish our own spiritual resources, like even this week on Shabbat. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Anna Salton Eisen, describes a dramatic confrontation that unlocked the pain her father had been carrying for decades and began a profound journey encapsulated in her new memoir, A Pillar of Salt. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Harvard Crimson newspaper's recent endorsement of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, has attracted far more wide-ranging attention than a typical student paper's editorial page, as faculty and alumni of the Ivy League institution line up to denounce the student paper's op-ed and condemn the shift in Israel discussion on college campuses in America. In an open letter, more than 100 Harvard faculty members objected to the paper endorsing an academic and financial boycott of the State of Israel, including Harvard's former president, Larry Summers, prominent psychologist and author Steve Pinker, endowed law professor Gabriella Bloom, Harvard Medical School dean, former one, Jeffrey Flyer, an emeritus law professor and longtime pro-Israel advocate, Alan Dershowitz, as well as past Two Jewish guest, Ruth Weiss. We believe that many well-meaning people with no hate in their hearts, including those at Harvard, gravitate to this movement, believing it offers a means for advancing Palestinian rights and peace in the Middle East, the letter says. But the reality is that BDS merely coarsens the discourse on campus and contributes to anti-Semitism. The letter was organized by the Academic Engagement Network, a pro-Israel campus advocacy group. Summers, a former U.S. Treasury secretary, said he signed the open letter in part to reassure Jewish students on Harvard's campus that they are not in a hostile environment and reassure the wider world that the student newspaper, The Crimson, did not speak for the broader university. The public should care about this Crimson op-ed, he said, because it's a widely read student newspaper with significant impact on the tone on campus, meaning Harvard's campus. He called the editorial anti-Semitic in a later op-ed and said he hopes that the Crimson will withdraw it. Anti-Defamation League ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt, a past guest of Two Jewish, who recently equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and many Harvard alumni, including Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, objected to the Crimson's op-ed. Cruz compared the editorial to Harvard's quotas on admitting Jewish students in the 20th century. When asked by a professor about the editorial as an example of the eruption of anti-Semitism on campus, Harvard President Lawrence Bacow, who is also Jewish, said the paper is entitled to publish what they wish and to share their views as they may, but he added that suggestions of boycotting groups over policy disagreements are antithetical to what we stand for as a university. The faculty letter lays out an opposition to the BDS movement, a defense of Zionism, and a condemnation of Harvard's Palestine Solidarity Committee, whose Wall of Resistance art installation on Harvard Yard inspired the Crimson's editorial. The faculty contend the installation had the effect of creating spaces on campus where Jewish and Zionist students are targeted and made to feel unwelcome. The faculty also called the students' decision to publish this editorial the day after Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, thoughtless. Thoughtless indeed. Deliberately so. A separate letter, signed by multiple generations of Crimson alumni, expressed dismay at the paper's editorial, along with messages of support for Harvard's Jewish students. The Crimson has broken with the paper's long-held editorial stance by endorsing BDS, which its editors favorably compared with anti-apartheid tactics, while stating that its aims were not anti-Semitic. Jewish groups at Harvard, including Harvard Hillel, strongly objected. Harvard Hillel student president Natalie Kahn, who is also a news editor of the Crimson and led protests against the Wall of Resistance, wrote her own op-ed in which she said the editorial is part of a larger trend, singling out Jews, conveniently neglecting our half of the story, and by extension our right to self-determination while claiming to, quote-unquote, oppose anti-Semitism. This Harvard dust-up is the latest example of academic battles over Israel boycotts all around the nation. Back in March, the Middle East Studies Association, an academic organization of Middle East and Israel scholars from around the world, also voted to endorse BDS. And in April, Jewish groups mobilized and stopped Ohio State and their student government from passing a BDS-inspired resolution. In other news, a three-day manhunt for the perpetrators of terrible Israel Independence Day terrorist attacks in the central city of Eilad ended with the arrest of two Palestinians. Asad Yusuf Asad al-Rifai, 19 years old, and Subhi Emat Spehat, 20, were charged with killing three people and wounding several others with an axe. Eyewitnesses reported they also used a knife. Authorities said they found the suspects in a forested area less than a mile from the site of the murders. They also released a video of the arrest in which Rifai can be heard confessing to having planned and carried out the attacks. Immediately after the attacks, the area was flooded with IDF forces, the Shin Bet Agency, and local police. No group claimed responsibility for the attacks. Local authorities say the men attacked two different locations. These terror attacks came amid multiple signs of rising tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, including clashes and arrests on the Temple Mount, and a monumental Israeli high court ruling that clears the way for the Israeli military to expel 1,300 Palestinians from an area that was declared an army training zone back in the 1980s. Last week, Palestinian terrorists in the West Bank settlement of Ariel murdered an Israeli guard. Israeli forces killed a Palestinian. In an ugly incident in Europe last week, Lufthansa apologized for kicking identifiably Jewish people off a flight from New York City to Budapest last week after some Hasidic individuals on the plane reportedly had not worn masks on the first leg of the flight. Lufthansa said in a statement that it regrets the circumstances surrounding the decision to exclude the affected passengers from the flight. Lufthansa also said the airline was reviewing the incident and regretted that the large group was denied boarding rather than limiting it to the non-compliant guests. What Lufthansa referred to as a group were about 100 Hasidic Jews, many of whom did not know each other, flying to Hungary on a pilgrimage. Most people were flying as individuals, said one passenger, Usher Schick. Lufthansa also apologized not only for the inconvenience, but also the offense caused and the personal impact. The German carrier has a zero-tolerance policy for racism, anti-Semitism, and discrimination of any kind, it said. What transpired is not consistent with Lufthansa's policies or values. We will engage with the affected passengers to better understand their concerns and openly discuss how we may improve our customer service. Well, maybe by not kicking off identifiably Jewish people just because. In a video taken by a passenger, a Lufthansa supervisor in Frankfurt, Germany, where the first leg of the trip terminated, is seen explaining the expulsion by saying everyone has to pay for a couple of people, adding it's Jews coming from JFK, Jewish people who were the mess, who made the problems. The video, first reported and shared by the discount travel website Dan's Deals, was posted on YouTube and Instagram, where it sparked angry comparisons to the treatment of Jews during the Holocaust. The Jewish travelers were on their way to Budapest to visit the grave of Rabbi Yeshaya Steiner, a wonder-working rabbi who died in 1925 and is buried in a village in northeast Hungary. An estimated 135 to 170 Jews were on the flight, 80% of whom wore Hasidic clothing. Rabbi David Zweibel of Agudat Israel of America, which represents Haredi, ultra-Orthodox Jewish interests, wrote a letter to Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr, asking that he research the disturbing accounts about the flight. People were being punished simply because they shared ethnicity and religion with the alleged rule violators, Zweibel wrote. I don't know what else to say except, and that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish Our Guests this morning. Anna Salton Eisen is a remarkable author and activist. She's written the book Pillar of Salt, A Daughter's Life in the Shadow of the Holocaust. She was here on Two Jewish not too long ago talking about her synagogue in Texas, which went through quite a lot. I want to touch base briefly on your own experience growing up as a second generation survivor. People don't know that term really so much, but they ought to. There's a kind, those of us who grew up among survivors know that there's many things that people didn't talk about. You just didn't talk about for a long time. You're active in second generation groups. How do other people approach that issue with their parents? When did they tend to learn the stories?
Well, I found out that there was a lot of similarities with other children of survivors. I mean, I think our parents wanted to protect us. I think that overall, you know, society wanted them to move forward. And there are some things that are just unspeakable. So a lot of us grew up not knowing the details, you know, realizing that it was a subject our parents didn't want us to talk about. Oftentimes, like in my home where my parents spoke, you know, five languages, they didn't want us to speak German or Yiddish. They really wanted us to be Americanized. And in many ways, we became, you know, the ambassadors to this new world for them. They had not experienced their own childhood. So even being a parent to them was something new. So our job was to, you know, make our parents happy, be well-adjusted, help us become American. And then I think over time, at least in my experience, I felt compelled to ask the questions, to know the truth, to find out, you know, why my father at times seemed you know, very sad. Now I, of course, understand it was grief. And, but it wasn't that he didn't want to talk. I think that when the time came and I asked him and, you know, he was very willing to talk and then, you know, take the family. I went on two trips with him to Poland, back to the place where he was in the ghetto, many of the camps, even into his town and into his childhood home.
Your description of, I'm not sure I know the correct pronunciation, being in Krakow and then going to Plaszow, is that the name of the second of the camps that he was interned in? It's painful even to read, just to hear about it and his experience. It must have been a grueling experience for your dad.
I mean, it was the War Painful Memories that was the Płaszów camp that was made famous in Schindler's List. It was actually built on the grounds of two Jewish cemeteries. And in that camp, he had to dig up graves with his bare hands. But I think there is some healing and it is cathartic to be able to finally tell and to have people bear witness to your testimony and accept you and offer compassion. Even later when he began speaking in public and people would come up and say, thank you for telling your story. I think he made the transition from being a victim to being a survivor. So yes, you know, it was difficult, but I think that he also was able to step into the role as a survivor, giving testimony, being surrounded by family, children, and grandchildren who wanted to know, took it seriously, grieved with him. But ultimately, I think he also felt somewhat victorious that he had survived. He had gone on and had another family and that he had, you know, tried to live a life worthy of the miracle, just that he was liberated after 3 years and had a chance at a new life.
What were the most extraordinary things you discovered in kind of recreating these experiences or revisiting, finding this catharsis with your dad?
Well, I think it was just finding out my family history and identity, for one, learning the names of the people, you know, discovering in my research through the Arlton Nazi Archives, original prisoner list from Flossenbürg in Germany, the Natzweiler camps in France, and just having it all be something that was tangible that I could continue to study, learn about. And that allowed me to connect with not just children of American liberators who gave him freedom, children of survivors who were with him, but even become part of a greater community involved with the Holocaust, historians, scholars, children of survivors, you know, were producing a documentary film. And to be surrounded by people who share your interest and passion, that connection has allowed me to really delve deeper into my studies and given me the reinforcement that this matters, it's important. And it's changed me in every aspect, from my Jewish identity and to just feeling that it's important for me to share the story. I've started doing book events, you know, not just at Holocaust museums and synagogues, but, you know, even being invited into churches. So those kinds of dialogues, I think, are really important to preserve the truth and accuracy of history and also hopefully address the rising anti-Semitism we see in our country and globally.
Your father had only, I guess you said, like a fifth grade education or something when the Holocaust took place. Obviously, the Holocaust wasn't the sum of his life. He came to America, started everything over, went on to get a bachelor's degree, master's degree, have a professional life, a family. You could
served
see
in the U.S. Army.
Served in the Army for 2 or 3 years. You know, became a citizen, of course, all of that. Did he feel, as you were growing up, as you and your siblings were growing up, that, you know, he'd put it all behind him and he just couldn't talk about it, didn't want to talk about it, he'd moved beyond that?
Well, I think, you know, to some degree, you know, going forward, you know, serving in the Army and having all these experience, getting an education, a job, made him feel that he had really transitioned. But on the other hand, this was always just, as he would say, beneath the thin veneer, that there were memories, there was unresolved grief, there was questions that were going on. And I think that when we got to the 1990s and we went to the formation of the U.S. Holocaust Commission, heard Elie Wiesel, and he started to, you know, see that it was talked about, the U.S. Holocaust Museum opened, Schindler's List came out. This made him feel, I think, accepted and gave him permission, so to speak, to talk about his experiences. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm also a licensed therapist, and I've worked in an outpatient psychiatry and with people who've experienced trauma. And being able to talk about what you've been through, integrate it into your identity, is important. And I think for him to grow up without his own name and without being able to speak about his past or history must have been difficult. I mean, at one point, I found a picture of his parents hidden in his sock drawer. And this, I think, must have been hard for him to feel that he couldn't talk about it. I will say, I remember when I was about 9 or 10, telling one of my friends just the little bit I knew, that my dad had been in a camp and that there had been boxcars and my grandparents were killed. And the mother, you know, approaching me, and she was Jewish, and saying, don't ever, ever talk about this again. So here my father had secrets, I had secrets, and I kind of felt that shame. I remember once in elementary, or I think it was maybe middle school, actually, you know, stealing a book from the library about the Holocaust that I found, because I thought, you know, no one should know that I'm learning this, that I want to know this. And so it was a secret that we all shared within our home, and until I was, you know, an adult and had moved away and found a Holocaust museum, became a docent, did the Spielberg interviews, and then decided that I was going to confront my father and find out what they did to him.
It's such a dramatic scene when you did. That must have been so difficult to do.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was a very gentle, loving man. He had a wonderful sense of humor, and I had really never seen him angry. And it was really quite surprising when I told him that we could hire a, you know, genealogist to go back to Poland and, you know, find some papers. And he just said, I am Adam. Everyone is gone. Nothing is left. It all starts over with me. And I said, no, you're not Adam. I need to know what happened. And I remember I got out a yellow legal pad and said, all right, Dad, you know, tell me the name of the camp you were in. And he's like, camp, 10 camps. And I was shocked. And of course, by the time I, you know, couldn't figure out how to spell them, the second or third, he just said, okay, give me the pen. I'll write it down. And then what he came back to me was with 600 pages, which I eventually helped him edit and co-write, and became his memoir, The 23rd Psalm.
You mentioned earlier the importance of remembering the Holocaust and writing about it and sharing and addressing the rising anti-Semitism in the world. The latest studies show that anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic acts, while not certainly always violent, have risen to a level we haven't seen in many years. How can a book like this help? How can your speaking about it help?
Well, when you look at countries, and I'm working with and connecting with people in Europe, and their countries were occupied. You know, whether you're in France or Germany or Poland, there are former concentration camps. It is visited by school children. It is memorialized every year as part of their history. And in our country, we were not occupied. And in fact, our liberators were really not encouraged to share their stories of bravery and what they saw when they liberated the camps. So I think, you know, in our country, you know, we're denying the Holocaust, even though we are not the perpetrators. And the perpetrators themselves, the Germans, you know, have penal codes forbidding the swastika. They have the Arlesen archives that document the accurate, true history. And they're trying to share this by bringing programs like Every Name Counts, which is when, you know, even high schoolers can go in and digitize original Nazi records. So my hope is that through education, through dialogue and exposure, that, you know, this will become preserved. And even when people read fiction, even though some of the accounts are, you know, made up, still every time someone reads a Holocaust book, you know, they internalize the idea that this happened. Maybe the exact story wasn't right and the names are made up. So I think that the more we can bring this in and teach it and teach the lessons, which is that, you know, at one time, a segment of the population was considered less than human. And because of that, they were denied education, jobs, and eventually, you know, there was a decision to murder an entire people. 85% of all Jewish children in Europe were killed. I mean, they came very close to wiping out a people of which, at least in Europe, there would not be the second generation, which is what I'm called. I can't even think of another time in history except for after the flood in Noah, where they, you know, where they started counting the generations. I've heard of first generation, but, you know, second generation within the Holocaust community really signifies, you know, this miraculous survival and that children, even after that, were born. I remember my father said when he went to the gathering of survivors in Washington, D.C., there was 2,000 survivors and about 5,000 offspring. And he said just seeing that to him was such a testimony to faith and hope and the belief that life would go on. And for him, it was a very, very moving experience to see that, because during the Holocaust, during his 3 years of imprisonment, he didn't see children. All the children had been gassed first with the elderly, and he only saw in the camps, you know, mostly men and some women who were between late teens and, you know, maybe 30s or 40s. But he never saw Jewish children.
It's an amazing story. The book is called Pillar of Salt, A Daughter's Life in the Shadow of the Holocaust. Where can people go to find out more about you, Anna, and to find out more about the book?
I have a website, which is annasaltandeisen.com. It has a lot of the original documents from the Arleson Archive, my father's artwork, which is at the U.S. Holocaust Museum and Yad Vashem, the Memorial Museum in Israel. It has a teaser for our documentary film. And of course, the books are available at all major online and in-person retailers.
Anna, thank you so much. And it's a terrific book and highly recommend it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be journalist and author Mati Friedman, whose new book is Who by Fire? Leonard Cohen in the Sinai, about the famed singer-songwriter's trip to Israel during the Yom Kippur War. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning is a very fun Israeli song from 2019 about the new Hebrew, which is actually full of English slang. It's called Ha'ivrit HaChadasha from the group HaTikva 6. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
יש לי דילי, אני בג'טלג, היה לי אוברווייט, קניתי אנבג, כתבתי מיילים, הוספתי ג'ייפג, אני לא בפוקוס, תוסיף לי השטג, סוואג. Oh my God, שפה קשה, העברית החדשה, אני לא מבין את המבטא, דבר אל העברית בבקשה. לא, אני בסטרס כל הקטע של העברית מתפספס סיריסלי, יש לי תחושה שזה קורס קייסס, זה לא בידיל, זה מבאס תראו, כולם היום עובדים 24-7 בלי הרבה תשוקה, עם המון פשן נונסטופ, חולמים על רילוקיישן על אקזיט מפואר, על סטארט-אפ ניישן יוצאים לדייטים, לאיזה רנדבו בלופ אחד, מדז'בו לדז'בו שוטים שוטים, צ'ייסרים, דרינקים עם כולם בונים על אפי אואר, על הנגובר חינם ועם בלנס, בין ההיל הלו חיים ריאליטי שואו
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.